Hello, on this week's program, David Patrick Stearns profiles Anthony McGill, the principal clarinet of the Metropolitan Opera, returns to the Philadelphia area for a concert celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society and for a solo performance with Symphony in C. We speak with Elizabeth Osborne. A new exhibition of her work at Locke's Gallery in Philadelphia shows the versatile veteran painter moving in a new direction. Susan Lewis considers the story of Mozart's life and music, as told in a production of Amadeus at the Walnut Street Theatre in Philadelphia. And Tom Keels explores the Stoogeum. The suburban Philadelphia Museum celebrates the life and legacy of the Three Stooges. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Anthony McGill left Philadelphia as one of the Curtis Institute's most promising graduates and is returning this week as one of the busiest classical clarinetists in the business. First for the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society's 25th anniversary gala, and then a week from today at Symphony in C in Camden. At age 31, he teaches at the Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore, as well as at the Juilliard School of Music, and will make a 10-day tour of Europe with pianist Mitsuko Uchida this spring, all the while working twice as hard as most orchestral musicians as co-principal clarinet of the Metropolitan Opera. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns caught up with McGill at the Met and also got a view from some of the worst seats in the house.
It was dark down there, but the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra pit, home of many sublime sounds that support the greatest opera singers in the world, is... Well, where do you start describing it? Well, for one thing, it's hazardous. Whenever the popular Bartlett Cher production of The Barber of Seville is on stage, there's some sort of an explosion that leaves clarinetist Anthony McGill showered with spongy little Smurf balls. During War and Peace, a net hangs over the orchestra pit to keep stray battle accoutrements from hitting the musicians. This week in Armida, the fog machine left musicians coughing. McGill is the last to know why. His only view of the stage is a fleeting glimpse of Renee Fleming when she's in the far right corner.
We have the worst seats in the opera house, the clarinets, bassoons. I sometimes strain and try to look up and see what's going on.
At least the pit is safer than the stage.
Well, that's the scariest when you're in a dress rehearsal or something and all you hear is someone screaming, "Stop! Stop! Maestro, stop!" And you're like, "What just happened?" It can be very dangerous.
One thing he can see is who's in the audience. In fact, his view of the auditorium is something close to omniscient. He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake.
Yeah, I can see the entire audience pretty much, except for the orchestra.
Even as far as the family circle, which is kind of halfway to Connecticut?
Maybe not that far. My neck doesn't stretch that far out.
McGill has come a ways from the south side of Chicago, Obama country, where he was raised by a high-achieving family. His older brother, a flutist, paved the way from the Interlochen Academy to the Curtis Institute of Music, where McGill studied with Donald Montanaro. McGill couldn't feel more affectionately towards Philadelphia. He calls it the city that got away, at least from him, because after Curtis, he had to go wherever he was hired, which happened to be the superb Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra. Then, 7 years ago, to the Metropolitan Opera. As an African-American clarinetist in the mostly white classical orchestral field, he senses some racism about him. Then again, he also has the prestige of having played chamber music during the Obama inauguration. But he can't think too much about the extra musical reasons influencing why certain things have or have not come his way.
You have to go through, not really ignoring it, but kind of. You can't judge everyone based on what they may think. And if you are absorbed with thinking about what everyone thinks about you, one would be crippled.
It's hard to imagine anybody resisting his playing for any reason. His clarinet, in many ways, resembles a speaking voice. There's a smoothness and legato. A quality that he shares with his predecessor, Ricardo Morales, who went from being principal clarinetist at the Met to the Philadelphia Orchestra. McGill has known Morales at least since he was 19, but if you ask him, his legato is one part of his playing that needs work.
What I actually am working on a lot is that teachers tell me not to swell on every note. You know, this is something that we wind players tend to do sometimes when we're trying to be more expressive. And what I'm trying to do is to sustain the expression through the phrase and over the bar lines, and like a string player pulling the bow across the string, and to imagine that the air is doing that. To tell the story, sometimes you can't get into every note individually. You have to actually tell the story over a series of 10 notes, 20 notes, or whatever, in order to communicate a sentence.
And at the opera, he's definitely in the business of telling stories, many of them quite long, stretching over 4 or 5 hours, though with the help of some of the greatest conductors in the business, starting with the Met music director, James Levine. The Met's guest conductors have also been extraordinary. McGill has played under Riccardo Muti, Fabio Luisi, and quite recently, Simon Rattle, in the mysterious Debussy opera, Pelléas and Mélisande.
Rattle just changed my life. Yeah, I was unbelievable. Unbelievable. You have some experiences that are so vibrant, you feel like you're so present in a moment that can never be taken away from you. That's what this experience was like. It's like I carry it around with me. It didn't just disappear after we played the final note. It actually changed who I am as a musician, because, you know, the operas are long, so you really are going through some sort of transformation while playing this stuff.
Il faut que je te parle ce soir, te dirai-je. Oui. Je sors de la chambre de mon père, il va mieux.
With experiences such as that, the attraction of a possible solo career isn't that strong for McGill. He recently recorded his first album, a lovely collection including the Poulenc Clarinet Sonata, and has a posh website revealing him in a very flattering light. But even though a solo career might be a logical step in a conventional career, McGill is the first to say that an artist's life hasn't the usual goals.
Playing music is not like building a house. You know, you don't finish it. You don't have a concert that you say, well, that's done. It's never done. It's a process that is ever-changing.
Still, his playing sounds so effortless, you wonder if it'll become too easy.
I never worry about that. It gets more difficult. When you get older, you start thinking more. And, you know, that gets in the way of everything. So you have to start practicing more so you don't think as much.
What a curious concept that your brain can be the enemy of making music. While the brain opens the doors of possibilities, it also closes them with fear, the source of all limitations. Besides, isn't musical performance an act of doing rather than an act of thinking? Particularly for clarinetists, the brain is just the starting point. And the rest? Well, I'll just keep my ears peeled to the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra pit to find out.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Anthony McGill joins, among others, pianist Emmanuel Ax, violist Roberto Diaz, and the Tokyo String Quartet for a concert celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theatre on Wednesday at 7:30. McGill is the soloist in the Mozart Clarinet Concerto with Symphony in C at 8 o'clock a week from tonight at the Gordon Theatre in Rutgers, Camden. The program also features works by Alfred Schnittke and Richard Strauss.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Artist Elizabeth Osborne was born, educated, and has spent almost all of her 70-plus years living and working in Philadelphia. She's especially well-known for her unique landscapes and for her use of vibrant colors. This year she retires from her alma mater, the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, where at the age of just 25, she became its first female faculty member in more than 40 years. Her work is featured in the Academy's collection, as well as in those of many other prominent institutions, including the Philadelphia Museum of Art, the Delaware Art Museum, and the Woodmere Art Museum. Locke's Gallery, which has represented Elizabeth Osborne since 1972, is now hosting her 9th solo exhibition. These paintings display an evolution in Osborne's style towards pure abstraction. When I spoke with Liz Osborne, I first asked her how this change had come about.
Color began to become very important in my work, and the landscape, when it was more literal and site-specific, where I'd go out and do something sitting on a rock or standing by a pond or whatever, at some point, I just began to think of color and using it in not to describe a tree or a branch or a mountain, but to think of it as it just shapes in its own and ways of making it just dazzle you at times or not. And I moved toward abstraction, which the
that
show,
was going to be the point, show, because you talk about still lives and you talk about and landscapes, always, and they're not identifiable as such, are they?
I'd always loved abstraction, and I thought, time for me to see what I can do with that. And I did. For this show, it's all abstraction, and it's working with, a lot of them are bands of color. Some are sort of a contained squares within squares. The last painting, which is called Tahrir Square, was kind of inspired by that momentous event, and actually a little different palette from the others. But the color and the painting within a painting is pretty much, I feel, a big leap for me in how I'm putting down what I want to say about my painting and how it is meaningful to me right now.
So these stylistic changes that in turn became phases in your work, was that an intellectual process, or was it that one day you went to the canvas and something was different that you hadn't anticipated?
I was looking at a show in New York at MoMA of abstract expressionist painters, and there was a painting in that show, a small painting by Barnett Newman, and it was kind of a rough little painting with a little red slash in the middle. And then the blurb by the painting explained that this was what triggered his huge and long-time series of what they call zip paintings. He elaborated on that theme for many years.
But it was the slashed canvas.
But it was that little canvas, evidently, that triggered that. And I pointed out to my dealer, Suyun Locks, that she has a painting in the back room, a part of the show, that was pivotal in this series of work, where it was bands of color, but there were a few little indications of landscape, because it was thought of, conceived as a landscape with just a lot of sky and a lot of reds and purples and grays. And I put that painting aside, and then a few months later brought it out and looked at it and said, this is something I really want to pursue, and I'm going to elaborate on this idea, because it's a step away from being more literal about nature and putting islands and rocks and mountains and whatever, trees. I'm sort of going to take that out of the paintings. And this painting was doing that. And so that...
So part happy accident, part conscious decision.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of artists, that happens. Sometimes you'll do something and you'll put it aside and then turn it around months later and say, hey, that was... That had something I need to look into further and explore it.
Elizabeth Osborne. An exhibition of her recent paintings is at Locke's Gallery in Philadelphia until March 30th. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, born 255 years ago, is still one of the world's most popular composers. A celebrated child prodigy who later struggled to support his family, his life story has engendered controversy and conjecture. Peter Schaffer's Tony Award-winning play Amadeus, turned into an Academy Award-winning film, has molded for many the image of this musical master and that of one of his musical contemporaries. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers our fascination with Mozart and his music as a production of Amadeus gets set for its last performance at the Walnut Street Theatre in Philadelphia.
It's difficult to overstate the contemporary appeal of Mozart, or the magnitude of his contributions. In his short life of 35 years, he wrote over 600 works, excelling in nearly every type of composition, including concertos, operas, and symphonies, as well as religious and chamber music. Malcolm Black is directing the Walnut Street Theater's new production of Amadeus.
Everybody has heard some of Mozart's music in their life. So people are interested in a very great artist, one of the geniuses of all time.
imagining how those melodies could come to you personally. It's a thrill to explore that type of mind.
Robert McClure plays the musical genius in Amadeus, a play which also explores what effect Mozart may have had on his contemporaries. What would it be like to know Mozart, especially if you were a serious musician with grand aspirations of your own? What if you were the composer Antonio Salieri? Salieri was a successful 18th century composer about 5.5 years older than Mozart. His work was performed throughout Europe. He taught Beethoven, Schubert, and Liszt. One of his operas was chosen to open La Scala in 1778. The play Amadeus, inspired by an earlier short play by Alexander Pushkin, later adapted to opera by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, speculates on the relationship between the two men, which may have mirrored a larger rivalry between German and Italian schools of music. Dan Olmsted, who plays Salieri in this production of Amadeus, says Mozart's music stirs in his character conflicting emotions.
He feels pain. He feels joy. He feels everything that a sensitive individual would feel listening to Mozart's music today. He just feels it more intensely, and he also feels like he's the only one who can appreciate it at that time.
The personal rivalry is seen through the eyes of an elderly Salieri, who claims that he not only sabotaged young Mozart's career, but in fact murdered him. Is the story true?
This play takes place in Salieri's mind. That's the reality.
While it is based on the historical figures of Mozart and Salieri, says director Malcolm Black,
in the play there are details of their relationship which you might say were, if not inaccurate, exaggerated to make the point of the play.
The two men have very different personalities. For the ultra-serious and pious Salieri, music is inextricably connected to God. Dan Olmsted, as Salieri, explains to the audience his passion.
Amici cari, I was born a pair of ears and nothing else. It is only through hearing music that I know God exists, only through writing music that I could worship. All around me, men hunger for general rights. I hungered only for particular notes.
Salieri makes a bargain with God, which Salieri feels that God doesn't keep the bargain.
Salieri wants God to make him a great composer, God's voice through music, in return for which he promises to live a virtuous and honorable life. Yet when he hears the music of Mozart, he feels both enraptured and betrayed.
Completely and utterly appreciates it to the point where it makes him collapse. And also, it's intensely painful because it's how he feels most viscerally God's rejection.
What makes it worse is that Salieri finds Mozart so distasteful as a person. Robert McClure says Mozart, celebrated as a prodigy as a child, never had a chance to grow up.
He has been so successful that he doesn't feel a need to obey behavior. I don't think he's got a sense of accountability to the rules of the period.
And so Mozart giggles, mocks the seriousness of others, and makes rude, flatulent noises.
That childlike positivity and sarcasm and wit infuriate Salieri. That God would choose such an obscene child, as he says, to bestow this gift upon. Why not someone much more virtuous and someone who's given his life back to God? Why didn't he pick that guy?
In the play, Salieri reaches a breaking point when, in an attempt to get work for her husband, Mozart's wife shows the court composer original scores, on which there appear to be no corrections.
When he takes the pen to paper, it's just transcribing what has already been completed in his mind.
Salieri does what he can to frustrate Mozart's career. The play takes place during the last decade of Mozart's life, when he broke ties with the court, a bold move which gave him artistic freedom but made him financially insecure, as one of the first freelance composers of the time, without a lot of networking skills. And yet,
he, in a sense,
is realer than all of the behavior in the room. He's the man who can say what's really happening when all of them are putting on a bit of a show.
In one scene, court officials are resisting Mozart's idea to write The Marriage of Figaro, an opera set in a boudoir. They insist that opera must celebrate the goddess, not the laundress. Mozart responds with passion about the power and possibilities of opera to depict real life.
All serious operas written this century are boring. Look at us. Four gaping mouths. But a perfect quartet. I'd love to write it, just this second of time, this now, as you are. Air Chamberlain thinking, impertinent Mozart, I must speak to the Emperor at once. And Air Prefect thinking, ignorant Mozart, debasing opera with his vulgarity. And Air Court Composer thinking, German Mozart, what can he finally know about music? And Mozart himself in the middle thinking, I'm just a good fellow, why do they all disapprove of me?
Two talented musicians, both seeking perfection, tormented by their respective circumstances.
The point of the play is to show you what it's like to be a very talented man, but have to accept the fact that somebody else, who you may not respect as a person, is even more talented.
What Salieri feels, says Dan Olmsted, speaks to most artists.
That fear of mediocrity, and that you may at some point need to accept your own level, and there will very likely always be a Mozart, just someone that you appreciate and you say to yourself, I'm not that.
Mozart is composing his Requiem when he falls ill and dies. He is buried in a mass grave. Salieri continues as one of the most celebrated composers in Europe and outlives Mozart by over 30 years, though haunted, in the play, by the knowledge that he destroyed his rival. True, somewhat true, or even false? Amadeus is about the life of Mozart, but it is also about the idea of him. A play about genius, but also about what genius inspires in the rest of us. Appreciation, greater aspirations, or envy.
WRTI Susan Lewis. The Walnut Street Theater in Philadelphia's final performance of Amadeus is tomorrow. The Philadelphia region is home to many world-class museums. There's the magnificent Philadelphia Museum of Art, the incomparable Barnes Foundation, and the sublime Stoogeum in Ambler, Pennsylvania. Now WRTI's Tom Keels explores the only museum in the world devoted to the life and work of the Three Stooges.
If you were a baby boomer brat who grew up in the Delaware Valley, chances are that you spent your afternoons watching the Three Stooges on Sally Starr's Popeye Theater. There was Moe, the mean authoritarian with the Dutch boy haircut, Larry, the hapless, frizzy-haired middleman, and Curly, that burly, bald-headed bundle of idiotic id.
Oh, wise guy!
I watched the Stooges religiously, at least until the age of 5, when I attempted the old finger-poke-in-the-eyes trick on my unsuspecting older brother.
Pick out 2 fingers.
1, 2.
Luckily, my brother preserved his sight by jumping back in the nick of time. From that day on, the Stooges were banned from our home. But their hold was strong enough to make my heart beat a little faster when I learned about the Stoogeum, located in an innocent-looking office building in Ambler. Gary Lassen welcomes us to the Stoogeum, backed up by life-size cutouts of Curly, Moe, and Larry. Lassen is a lifelong Stooge fanatic, a collector of Stooge memorabilia, and even a Stooge relative by marriage. His wife is the granddaughter of Larry Fine's brother, Moe Feinberg. When Moe Feinberg died, Lassen inherited not only his Stooge collection, but his presidency of the Three Stooges fan club. Lassen began to dream of a place where he could host club meetings and display all of his Stoogabilia.
Even though my wife was related to the Stooges, she didn't really have any interest in eating off of Stooges' dishes. But I tucked the idea away that someday I'd like to have a place with all my stuff out, and it was a living and breathing, you know, Stooges museum.
Lassen opened the Stoogium in 2004. The building houses an 85-seat movie theater and an art gallery. It also displays thousands of items which tell the story of the Stooges from their start in 1925 as a backup act for vaudeville star Ted Healy. The original members, brothers Moe and Shemp Howard, were joined in 1928 by Philadelphia native Larry Fine, a dropout from Central High School.
They saw this fellow who was just the right size, the same size as they were, and he was playing the violin and doing that Russian dance, and Ted Healy liked him, thought he was a funny guy, could help the act, and told him they'd give him $90 a week to join. They'd give him $100 if he'd get rid of the violin.
In the early 1930s, the Stooges split with Healy and moved to Hollywood. Shemp left the group to pursue his own career as a comedian. He was replaced by younger brother Jerry Howard, who shaved off his hair and then, with Stoogian logic, called himself Curly. In 1934, the Three Stooges signed with Columbia Pictures to star in a series of short comedies that became wildly popular. Professor Peter Seeley of Benedictine University, editor of a book called Stoogeology, sees the Stooges as characters that even downtrodden Depression audiences could look down on.
One of the key elements of comedy is that you have somebody that you can feel superior to. And who could you feel more superior to than the Three Stooges? I mean, they were homely, they were stupid, they were naive, and they kept getting placed in these various scenarios and various circumstances that they couldn't function.
Most of these scenarios involved elegant settings, formal parties where the proletarian Stooges were mistaken for ambassadors or artists. While Groucho Marx might have met this situation with a wry quip, the Three Stooges met it with brute force, destruction of priceless heirlooms, and a cream pie in the hostess's face. Peter Seeley detects social undertones in the Stooges' chaotic, often sadistic, comedy.
And it really was subversive. I mean, the Stooges were anarchists at their most extreme, and their ineptitude seemed to come out the most when it was somebody from the upper class. You might almost be led to believe that there was some political message that was coming through in a number of those scripts, that the rich were very rarely ever portrayed in anything approaching a positive light throughout the whole series of films.
The Stooges stayed at Columbia Pictures for 24 years, cranking out hundreds of films and making millions for their studio. But they never received one raise during that entire period. Gary Lassen describes the Stooges' bitter departure from Columbia.
When their contract ended there in 1958, they were basically shut out from the studio lot. Mo Howard would come back and was told he's not given permission to get onto the lot after 24 years of working there. There was no farewell party, there was no recognition at all for everything they had done.
But thanks to television, the Three Stooges met the baby boom generation, and a lasting love affair began. A walk through the Stoogium proves that the spirit of the Three Stooges lives on, not just in their own films, but in cartoons like The Simpsons and Family Guy, not to mention in the heart of every bored dinner guest who's ever dreamed of taking that $400 concept cake shaped like a Birkin bag and shoving it smack in his hostess's kisser.
WRTI's Tom Keels. The Stoogium at 904 Sheba Lane in Ambler is open once a month. It's next open tomorrow. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and C under music director Rossin Milnoff. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.